Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And who would believe we're already into July? I keep waiting, actually, for summer. And somehow or other, it's eluding me this year.
Well, winter wasn't so bad. It's just that spring's been very damp. Here in the Berg, it's been very damp all over the country, I guess.
All over the world.
Yeah, all over the world. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well.
But anyhow, we're doing a miscellany today, I believe.
What, miscellany, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
I'm not sure. Your British way of pronouncing it.
Okay, very good. Well, then that must be the right way then.
I don't think so.
We've got people writing cookbooks on almost every topic you can imagine.
Right.
In today's program and starting out for those of you who don't understand the cult of meat broth, beef broth in particular.
Bone broth.
Okay, well, it's meat
bone
broth.
Bone broth. Well, meat no. Specifically,
can be fish broth.
All right.
We had a long conversation about it, so why don't we just start
Listen to Nick Sandler try to explain this. Nick Sandler, you've written, what is it, 7 books, cookbooks?
I have written a number of cookbooks. This is my 7th cookbook.
Okay, and the book we're talking about is called The Magic of Broths, 60 Great Recipes for Healing Broths and Stocks and How to Make Them. Now, you are a chef, right?
I am a chef.
I find that we've got a lot of books on bone broths and whatnot lately because it's a very trendy subject, but I'm wondering if you could explain when a bone broth or a broth becomes a soup, because I would call this book a book about soups.
Okay, many people have asked me this question. Now, what I would consider to be a broth is something that's been fortified generally with bones. And it could be beef bones, it could be chicken bones, it could be pork, or it could be fish or a number of other types of bone. And once these bones have been simmered, sometimes with vegetables, for a number of hours, the goodness from the bones is extracted into the stock, should we call it, into the broth. And so this is the way I would define a broth. And the reason why the book's called The Magic of Broth is because the recipes are all derived from broth.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so broth, so in this cookbook, broth of different kinds is one of a number of ingredients in a dish that's sort of generally soupy.
I didn't want to do in the book is I didn't want the recipes to be, should we say, empty. I'm a chef and I love great food, and I've always used broth in my cooking. I've always made a good broth and I've always made an intense broth, and I use broth in many recipes. So if I'm cooking, let's say, broccoli, I might just put a little puddle of broth in at the bottom of a pan, put my broccoli in, and as well as making the broccoli just a little bit healthier, it also makes it taste much better. And as a chef, you know, the reason why I use a lot of broth is because it tastes great. If you, the way I make my broth, should we say my everyday kitchen broth that I make every week from bones from the farmer's market, is I get bones from a variety of different sources. I get my pig's trotters, I get some beef bones, some beef marrow bones are great, sometimes some chicken bones go in there as well, and lots of vegetables. So I use carrot, sometimes a little bit of leek, celery, onion, garlic, and some dried mushrooms, sometimes some tomato. And then I take water and I fill it to just above the level of the last bone and simmer it. And simmer it very, very slowly. Now, what I call a simmer is a gentle stream of bubbles coming up from the bottom of the pan. You know, not boiling, not a rolling boil, just a gentle, gentle simmer. And if you do that over a period of, let's say, a minimum, I'd say, you know, around 8 hours, then the resulting, it's like an elixir, you know, it just tastes great. Now, I then take this elixir and I pour it generally into little glass pots while it's still hot, screw the lid on, and then chill it down. in either, if it's cold outside, I just put it outside, or if not, in a sink full of cold water. And what that does is it cools the broth down very, very quickly, and it turns into a sort of a gel, and that's the collagen in the bones. Once it's turned into this gel, you can put it into your fridge. And it has a shelf life of a good week, up to 2 weeks I keep it in the fridge. And then I look to my broth for, as I say, cooking vegetables, or if I want a soup with noodles, or many, many other things. So that's why I suppose I call it the magic of broth. So I was originally coming at broth very, very much from a chef's point of view. And it was only later that I started to hear about all the health benefits.
Well, you really investigated it deeply, didn't you? Because you did two different diets, tried to approximate to what the long-term valuable effects would be of a broth-filled diet. You want to just go over those results for us?
Well, I'll tell you I'd like to say a little bit about myself.
But, oh, sure, so sure, certainly.
I do lead a high-energy lifestyle.
You climb mountains.
That sort of thing. I do a lot of climbing, both outdoors and indoors. I'm a creative chef, and I have jobs, you know, that can engross me for a period of days. And I lead a very busy lifestyle with my children. And I've always noticed during my life that I've suffered from a number of different things. And one of them is that mid-afternoon slump. I can be driving along in the middle of the afternoon, and I need to pull over to the side of the road. I just feel like going to sleep, and there's nothing that can stop me. And there's another thing that I've suffered from, and I've found out since that there are a number of other people who suffer from it. And I call it brain fog, and it can happen any time, usually when I'm supposed to be concentrating on something. So I suppose that in the back of my mind, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to give the diet a really, really good go to see whether it would make any difference to my life. And I was thinking about mental, I suppose, and physical abilities. So I tried two basic diets. And the first diet was one where I just included broth with every meal and didn't worry too much about anything else. I just wanted to make sure that I got a good dose of broth every day. And yes, did. Well, it did improve things in the way I didn't lose any weight. I probably needed to lose 1 or 2 pounds, but it did improve my physical performance. There was absolutely no doubt about that.
Huh.
Then I tried. Go on.
No.
Don't forget to tell us about whether or not you can grow hair with broth.
That's unfair.
Yes, I'll come to that. I'll just tell you quickly about the second diet. So the second diet was much more of a calorie controlled diet, and I still had broth for every meal, but I also watched what I had between meals as well. And consequently, I didn't put this in the book, but consequently, I became gluten-free during this diet as well. So it can suit people who decide they don't want to have any gluten in their diet. That, for me, was the really life-changing one, because I found that I did lose weight, and those slumps went. I found the brain fog went. I mean, it was really, I felt a little bit religious about it. It was really quite weird. And ever since that day, you know, even though I don't have broth every meal now, but I do really keep in mind reducing those calories, keeping a lot of broth in my diet for high performance. And yes, you were mentioning that a lot of people, you can't see this obviously over the radio, but, I'm as bald as a coot. So I did want to see whether it would make my hair grow again, because a lot of the Hollywood actors and actresses had said that it made their hair very shiny, but I'm afraid that it did. It did nothing for me at all.
Well, it's very shiny. It's just very light colored.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Now there's another fundamental principle that comes through in your book, and it varies from I guess animal to animal, or kind of broth to kind of broth, and that is whether or not you roast the bones first.
Actually, you know what, since I wrote the book, I have changed ever so slightly, but generally I never roast my chicken bones.
Right.
And the reason being, unless I'd save some chicken bones from a roast or something like that and use that in what I call one of my dirty stocks. A dirty stock is basically a stock that everything goes. You throw the kitchen sink into it just because you don't want to waste it. But generally, I don't roast my chicken bones. I don't roast my pork bones, but I always roast my beef bones. And with the beef bones, I find that if you don't roast them, and again, it's a chef's thing. If you don't roast them, you get absolutely no flavour out of them at all. And it's a really lovely flavour, that flavour of, like, marrow bone. It releases the marrow, and it gives it a lovely, lovely caramelised flavour. So,
you know, there's no absolutely no nutritional value in marrow at all.
But it tastes delicious.
It does taste delicious. But
yeah, I was shocked.
It's a myth. It's a total myth.
I was shocked when Anne told me that. I'm sure my mother used to give me that to try to make me look like I was thriving better when I was a child.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm not a nutritionist, but I did work with a nutritionist. And she said to me, she said, what is the use of taking one of these stupid collagen tablets when you can have it in a perfectly delicious form through eating bone broth? And it really, you know, when you've got a good gel on your bone broth, for every spoon of that bone broth, it's about 3 or 4 of those pills at least, and it tastes great, of course.
You know, there's a chain of faux restaurants in London. What's the name of it? It's the best faux
I've
ever had.
That is actually what it's called. It's called faux. You said there's a chain of restaurants in London who do faux. You're referring to the Vietnamese beef stew.
No, this is a restaurant that specializes in noodles in broth.
It's ramen shop, not faux. There's
about 5 of them, and I think the name starts with S. But they're Chinese.
Okay, well,
they're Japanese.
But they're ramen. I'm sorry, I said faux by mistake because I was looking in your book.
They're Japanese. The owning family is Japanese.
And it's pork based, and they simmer it for
like 24 to 48 hours, I think, or something like that. And
it's the best stuff you'll ever eat.
it takes on the most amazingly. No, you can feel it doing you good as you eat it.
Exactly.
I will tell you something about the way they make their broth. Is they use a very interesting method. As opposed to simmering their broth, they actually keep it at a rolling boil, and that action, it actually dissolves the fat back into the stock. So they get a very rich, almost, so it's got both fat and collagen in it.
Uh-huh.
Which is, and I don't disapprove of it by any means. No, I think it's absolutely great and it really suits their cooking. But it's very, very different to the way I do my broths. What I do is when I simmer my broths, because I simmer them, all the fat goes to the surface. Then, when I decant my broth into glass containers, all the fat sits on the top. And once cool, it's like a white disc on top. And before I use the broth, I actually remove that fatty disc. I might end up using it in something else. Let's say if you're roasting potatoes or something like that, it's absolutely delicious. But generally, I will remove the fat from my broth. But for these Japanese places, it is the rolling boil is a way to get the fat into the broth.
I see. Okay,
tastes good.
and that's why it tastes so good.
That's why it tastes so fantastic, yes.
There you go. So as long as you don't mind getting a little bit of fat in your diet, you're okay.
You have a lot of different ethnic references, classic ethnic soups in your book. What is a steamboat?
Steamboat is a way of enjoying bone broth and cooking beautiful ingredients in bone broth and sharing with your friends or family. Steamboat is it's made of stainless steel container, and in the middle of it you put some charcoal which burns, and that charcoal heats up the container in which you've got the bone broth. You would then add your ingredients into the bone broth, and each country has their own version. So, for instance, in Japan it's called shabu shabu, and you know, it's almost like onomatopoeia, the way you just like you wave the meat or the vegetables. And we don't really have that in the UK, although I did invent an English-style steamboat which had beef in, and it had horseradish dumplings in it as well, which are really delicious.
Sounds cool.
Yeah, there's a Korean dish that involves your getting a piece of meat and raw meat and then putting it in the broth, right?
Yes,
that's right.
Or something like that.
Yes, and then as you cook your meats, various meats in the broth, you're improving the flavour of the broth the whole time, and so by the end of the meal, you just drink the broth and it's all gone. Now my kids absolutely love this DIY way of eating. It's a really great way to introduce kids to, should we say, you know, more diverse foods that they maybe wouldn't normally eat, because it's a such fun way of doing it. But it's also a great way of having a dinner party as well, because it's, you know, it's slow. You know, you can have lots and lots of ingredients. You know, if you are going to the Far East, you can have anything, you know, from shrimp to chicken to beef, to all sorts of vegetables and noodles, and it's in fact we just had one the other night and it was really good fun.
Well, bone broth is big in the USA right now. We hope for the sake of your selling lots and lots of copies of your book that bone broth will catch on in the UK in the same way. If it hasn't already, we feel sure it would, or it will.
I had no idea that bone broth was so enormous in the USA.
Oh, yeah.
I did know one thing about bones, is that when I go to the farmer's market to get my bones now, and this didn't happen a year ago, I have to order them in advance, because if I don't, they're gone.
Right.
I sent my wife, and my wife's Malaysian Chinese, and it was a bizarre, I was away, and I said, look, you must go to this guy and collect my marrow bones on Saturday. But somebody else has staked a claim on the marrow bones as well. And I think there was a bit of a standoff that went on. In fact, the Jersey Milk guy related it to me the following week. He said it was messy. He said it was very messy.
Oh, dear.
Oh, you sound like you have a good time through all this.
Yeah, listen, next time we're in London, we'll have to get together and you can regale us with more stories of bone broth. I'm sure bone broth part two might be underway by then. In the meantime, it's been so much fun talking to you, Nick. And
I'll be absolutely delighted to put you up and to feed you bone broth. and if anybody, by the way, you know, I discovered Instagram a few weeks ago, and I'm on Instagram as Nick's_ingredients.
Got it.
Okay, but we have your email. We have your email as well too.
Yeah, but for listeners, they could get on his Instagram account.
Okay, so give my regards to Kensal Rise and Queen's Park and all those parts of London that I used to know, and we're so glad you joined us. And we don't know which way you're voting on June 23rd, but we're sure you'll make a wise choice.
I don't think anybody knows which way they're voting.
Right.
Well, it's a difficult decision.
Yeah, well, I don't know which is worse, your election or ours. Anyhow, Nick Sandler, thank you for coming on. Again, the book is The Magic of Broths. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Back in the day, as they say, there were a couple of entertainers, Michael Frayn and Donald Swann, who used to make up songs and sit at the pianoforte and perform them, and everybody thought it was very funny. And one of their most favorite songs went, "The English, the English, the English are best. I wouldn't give tuppence for all of the rest." Now, what does that have to do with the program? Well, it turns out that we just finished up with a bone broth recipe book from an Englishman, and the next one up, what is it called, sweetheart?
It's called Cooking, Blokes and Artichokes.
And it's another Englishman at the helm.
You can tell because he uses the term blokes.
There we go. We,
he also
can
uses
tell that.
Mates, and he uses all those other things that.
We're pretty sure he's English, not Australian, but we could be wrong. Anyway, Blokes and Artichokes sounds like the kind of book you should give to your friendly male friend who doesn't cook so that he can learn how. Does the sound about right?
Right. Why do you think he's not English?
Well, no, I said maybe he's Australian. If he, Australians say bloke too. That's the only reason I was pointing it out. It's really not very important, as usual. Anything I say is really not very important. So let's. What's the guy's name?
Brendan Collins. And okay. He's worked in all these London restaurants.
Great. So he must be a pretty bright guy. Brendan Collins knows the Sheriff of Nottingham. At least that's what he told me. Because that's where he was born, and those of you who have watched the various versions of Robin Hood and know that he was the sheriff was a wicked, wicked man, but Brendan saw a nicer side to him and decided that he would follow in the sheriff's footsteps and become a chef. How about that for an introduction?
That's a good one.
And you are a chef, and you are in Los Angeles, having cooked yourself in a variety of different places, which we'll talk about. The reason that you're with us today is you have a book with a very interesting title called Cooking Blokes Plus Artichokes. Please explain that title.
I come from England, so the book has been released in England and in Australia also. So, you know, maybe the Americans don't know what blokes mean, but the other two countries certainly do.
Yeah, I would say.
You just selected it because it rhymes with artichokes.
Well, absolutely.
That was very clever. But you've got a mixture of recipes. You've got recipes which are very traditional, old English that I recognize. Except undoubtedly you fix them so that they actually taste good. When in my house they definitely didn't all the time. But then you've got classically trained French.
Then
you've got all kinds of modern stuff too.
You know, I think that's the beauty of food, isn't it? There's no really right or wrong. It's just whether or not you have the experience and the expertise to cook it. You know, it's very easy to just, you know, cook comfort food and stay within your comfort zone and be satisfied. But I think there's something about cooking and food that can really excite both the senses and visually. So I want to make sure good, solid repertoire of recipes. You know, in your back pocket that you can pull out just sort of any time. But also as the guys gain confidence in the kitchen, that they would have these other recipes.
On purpose, writing this as a modern man's kitchen handbook. What made you migrate to a men's cookbook?
Well, I think the reality is that, you know, there's, you know, if you go to a bookstore, there are a million cookbooks up there, and none of them really, apart from the grill books, you know, Get the Guy on the Grill, were actually generated towards the male, towards a man actually cooking. And, you know, I grew up in a family where the men really were the best cooks. My granddad was a really good cook. My dad was a really decent cook. My uncle, who married an Italian woman, was an exceptional cook. So for me, it just sort of made sense that it was something that I'd grown up with, but as you're looking around the bookstore, I noticed that most of the books were either restaurant or chef generated, or, you know, mainly pointing towards the female audience. So I was like, why not do one for the guys? You know, write one.
At our swim club, it's a joke that all the women sit around gossiping and the men sit around exchanging recipes.
Well, now they've got a book where they'll actually be able to do that.
Oh, we could do that before your book came along. We'll just be able to do it better now. That's all. We'll be able to see Brendan said that, and Brendan said that, and Brendan said that. So it must be right, because you're a real professional, right? Yeah, professionally trained, professionally occupied right now.
I'm very fortunate. You know, it was something that I really wanted to do, and I was able to go to cooking school in England. Straight after cooking school, I moved to London to work with some of the greats. Mark Bilois and the Roux brothers.
You worked at La Gavroche, which we know well, and also at Quo Vadis, which I didn't know it in your era, but Jeremy is. Who's there now? Jeremy is?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Quo Vadis.
Jeremy Lee.
Jeremy Lee is cooking there now. We know Quo Vadis really well.
Yeah, he was. Jeremy was at a place called the Blueprint Cafe, And the Hart brothers have not confided in me what it took to persuade him to get out of there.
Right. Probably quite a bit.
Yeah, we interviewed him there. We interviewed Jeremy there. And he said, I'm never going to leave.
Yep.
Yeah, Corvallis was a great restaurant. You know, it had a Michelin star while we were there. And it was, you know, it was under the leadership of Marco Pierre White, obviously a very, very famous English chef. And, you know, and it was while I was working at Corvallis that, I met a lovely young American lady who, sort of convinced me that, you know, maybe after 10 years of, you know, working in London, it was maybe time to get out of there. And that was when I moved to Los Angeles, which at the time, and in hindsight, was probably not the best culinary move for me. But I was very fortunate to work in a great restaurant out here as the chef de cuisine for 4 years, which ended up winning two Michelin stars. A place called Melis.
Are you still there or are you somewhere else? No, you're somewhere else.
No. I actually own three of my own restaurants.
His own restaurants.
Got it.
And they are? You might as well advertise them.
The main restaurant that I have is Birch, which is in Hollywood. And then I have a small beach restaurant in Venice called Larry's. And then I have a small cocktail bar in Culver City called The Corner Door.
Venice is where those guys who make all the salt and spice combinations come from. It's not Gulag, something else. That's with a G. And they started making spice combinations in their home kitchen, and now they sell them all over the place, and they're really good.
I remember it was a long time ago.
Gustus Vitae, that's what they're called.
I don't know those guys.
No, they're good.
You should look them up. I mean, Gustus Vitae. That'll get you close enough. Right.
I used a company called Le Sanctuaire in Venice a long time ago. We're a phenomenal company. They're an amazing company. And they import all their own spices, whole spices, and then they make their own grinds. Yeah. They're amazing.
That's exactly what these guys are doing, too.
Well, the guy in New York, though, is the one, the French guy.
Now, what's on your menu at your restaurants? I mean, is it roast beef and Yorkshire pudding, the kinds of things that you have in your book? Or is it a bit different than that?
At Birch, we actually do a roast on a Sunday. We do it every single Sunday. And it's amazing, and it's literally like an episode of Coronation Street or Downton Abbey. You know, all the British expats flock to us on Sundays, which is good. We like that. But generally, it's more of a Mediterranean-based with some Asian influences, you know, uber seasonal, very, very seasonal. We have amazing farmers markets in California, and we utilize them to the absolute maximum. And then Larry's is a bit more of a comfort food style restaurant. So, you know, burgers and pizzas and, you know, good, well done, really done, really very, very well. But we only have a very small kitchen over there, and we do an exceptional amount of custom. So if you try and get too clever with the menu, you basically end up, you know, it doesn't work out. You end up making bad food, not good food. Birch, we were just nominated one of the best new restaurants by the LA Magazine, one of the best new restaurants by the Time Out Magazine. We've had a phenomenal success with that restaurant, and, you know, the business just keeps growing and growing. Very small restaurant, only 50 seats. So, you know, it gives us, and we have a decent sized kitchen there, but it gives us the opportunity to make beautiful and delicious food there.
You know, one of my favorite sections of this book, actually, is because you do this, these, I don't know, what do you call them, enhancements, relishes, condiments is what you call them. You make one of these, and you can elevate any dish. I mean, pickled mustard seeds, that seems like I could make that in a minute.
Yeah, a lot of these things are so simple to make. It's just actually, you know, following the recipe or, you know, putting the effort in to make them. And a lot of them, especially when it comes down to like pickles and, you know, condiments, because they have so much salt and sugar and the pH, level is so high, they last for months in the refrigerator. And like you say, you know, for instance, the pickled mustard seeds, you make a pound of pickled mustard seeds, it's going to give you 2 quarts of pickled mustard seeds and they'll last you for months. And, you know, you spread it on whatever you want, you know, a little bit of cheese on a nice, you know, nice bit of cheese on toast with some pickled mustard seeds, and it's amazing.
Sounds like my carrot pickle.
Yeah, carrot pickle. That's the Indian.
I bought a jar of carrot pickle.
And then throw it out after 20 years.
It only got thrown out when we bought a new refrigerator. But one of my latest new toys is mustard seed oil.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever tried that?
We actually make a version of our own, yeah, and we use it on a scallop crudo with yuzu. It's really good, yeah.
Somebody in L.A. is importing it from mustard seeds grown in Australia.
From Australia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating.
We have the interview. I can't remember whatever it is. There's something in most mustard seeds that are toxic. But this particular brand of mustard seed that they use to make this oil doesn't have the toxins in it, so it's safe to eat.
Wow.
And we used it on, we rubbed it on fresh tuna steaks. It was wonderful.
That sounds good.
I had a question. Is your preserved lemons, I've never seen a preserved lemon recipe that called for sugar.
Yeah, I've always used sugar in mine. It's a bit more of a Moroccan style one. And it helps with the oversweetness. I mean, it helps with the oversaltiness. It kind of really gives you that nice balance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also really much better for the makes the curing process a little bit quicker. And I use it for all sorts of things. We do our own limes. We do kumquats. We just did this recently that we're serving with crab and squash blossoms at the moment.
Wow.
It's a really good process. Always, always. You should always use sugar.
You also have...
And even if you're curing fish, it's always, you know, if you're doing a little like Gravlax or, you know, a little cured whitefish, always do a combination of salt and sugar.
You got a little humor into your instructions here. I particularly liked your technique for making octopus salad about how to tenderize your octopus. I mean, frankly, we beat it on the rocks in the stream.
You know, I think that's the beauty of cooking. There is so much. There is a lot of humor in it. There are a lot of things that you do that you wouldn't imagine that you do. And it's same again. There's no right and wrong. It's not like joining wood or, you know, or building a brick wall or, you know, welding metals together. It's what it really is all about is, can you do it? Are you interested in doing it? Are you prepared to put the labor in which to do it? And then are you going to be happy and sit down and enjoy it? I think that's the beauty of cooking. And that's the creative artistic side of it too, is that there really isn't any right or wrongs. It's such a personal preference. And that's what keeps our industry so interesting.
Well, there's so many delicious recipes in this book. I have never actually tried this roasted whole pig's head, although I have had it at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. It was
Heads and Tails. Fergus Henderson
Henderson's
did.
Recipe.
He did Heads and Tails. I have to say that he was very courageous to make the presentation because of this Parkinson's disease problem that he has.
But right.
at the same time, I have to say the pig's heads and the pig's tails were not all that good.
You know, I think I really enjoy pig's head, and it's, you know, as long as you do a really good brine on it, I think that's the most important thing. That's what takes away that kind of awfully, overly irony flavor. And then the technique that I've given, it really keeps the underneath the skin of the pig's head really nice and moist, and it really helps also get the cracklings on the face. It's just one of those little dishes that...
Well, Peter will tell you the story about how a neighbor in Australia told me I absolutely had to do this pig's head, and so I went off to the butcher shop, and it so happens that the countertop, the glass countertop, was directly at eye level with me, and the butcher whips out this pig's head and sets it right there. It's looking right at me, and it has one brown eye and one blue eye, and I couldn't do it.
so instead, you used pig's trotters, and
made a mess.
You made pig's trotters with the red sauce.
Don't tell them that.
And spinach pasta.
was awful.
And it was you didn't know whether to, you didn't know whether to stop or go. If you get what I mean. Now,
tell him that we made.
I have to put in this warning before I forget. This book is filled with words that guys use when guys talk to guys.
English guys, particularly.
Australian guys in particular.
Australian guys in particular.
So if you're a little sensitive to four-letter words, just be careful. Just be careful how you read this book and don't read it out loud to your friends.
and tell him that we already started experimenting.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I didn't have all the ingredients required for the cauliflower, but I did use your cumin seed seasoning, and it does indeed work extremely well. Now, there were some other ingredients that I didn't have, but I started them off, and I also used olive oil. No, I used grapeseed oil instead of butter.
Mm.
But I did get it nicely browned, just like you're suggesting. And I did essentially put it through the process twice and then thought it was very good.
We did it last night, and I had leftovers for lunch.
Good. I'm glad you guys are using the recipes. I'm glad you're enjoying them.
Yeah, and you also have a special section on special days, holiday cooking, so to speak, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to, you know, I think, without sounding too, We like to go out and we like to work, but I think when we take some time off, and usually that's around the holidays, you know, the stress is off, and, you know, hopefully I can get some of these guys back into the kitchen during those, you know, those holiday and festive times. And I figured that the best way for that would be to put a section in there, you know, and give people some good recipes, and hopefully they would use them.
Be still, my beating heart. There is indeed a recipe for sticky toffee pudding here.
That's a good one, too.
We'll try that one, huh?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
a really good one.
Yeah,
you're going to like that one.
We eat lots of sticky toffee pudding around here.
Good. Yeah, we too.
We
really don't. Eat and mess. Now, that's important. That's Downton Abbey in Spades, right? I bet they have eat and mess.
There's a very similar one as well called a Lancashire mess, which is pretty much exactly the same thing. But I guess they were just a north-south divide thing that they were trying to.
there's probably an east-west divide too. I mean, no self-respecting Yorkshireman will make a Lancashire hot pot, for heaven's sake.
That's right. You've got the War of the Roses. I forgot about that.
But we used to have this pudding every Sunday in my college dining hall at Cambridge. It was called Cabinet Pudding. So named because it had all the best parts of all the desserts that had been served during the week. And it has a historical connotation because after William Pitt the Younger passed away at age 35 as a result of all the port that he drank, a gentleman called Lord Liverpool became the Prime Minister. And he said, I am not qualified to be Prime Minister, but I will assemble a cabinet of all the talents. And that's,
oh, wow.
And that's how cabinet government really entered the modern political scene, and it's also how cabinet pudding entered my diet every Sunday. And it was served with the most disgustingly flavored fruit sauce you've ever had in your whole life.
Tell you what, if you put some custard on it, it'd probably be all right.
Yeah, they did. It was, yeah, the chunks of cake were indeed glued together with custard. You were right. You guessed it.
Well, I'll tell you, you're an honest man, Brendan Collins, because you here as this culinary superstar admit that one of your most satisfying desserts is Twix.
It is. There's nothing wrong with a good piece of Twix.
So you devised a dessert recipe for it. It looks a whole lot better than a Twix bar to me.
Right. Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, obviously, I think it's Nestle who does Twix. They're onto something, you know. That it's such a great combination of flavors, textures, you know, that mouth feel from the chocolate. You know, what better dessert to do than to emulate something that they've done so well. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that we put that together. And, you know, I've always been a big lover of, you know, panna cotta or pudding, as we call it in England. you know, and then using the textures. And it's kind of like a Twix trifle, I guess, would be the right word for it, but without the jelly. You know, and it's just one of those really easy eating desserts that you can go back and have three or four bowls worth of it and not really feel guilty until, you know, probably the next day.
Well, Brendan, you've achieved a real masterpiece right here in so many different respects. Here's what you have to do. Guys, you're entitled to go buy this cookbook for yourself. Gals, you will endear yourself to your beloved if you give them a copy of this book, because it will make you feel that you can be independent of them and cook for yourself. And we wish you great success with your restaurants in Los Angeles. And if you're out there on the left coast, don't forget Birch is the name of the place they're supposed to go, right, Brendan?
That's it. That's the one.
Thank you for joining
Birch
us today.
My pleasure.
And before we go up any further with the program, we better take a break. So we'll do that, and we'll be right back. So don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
It's hard to believe that our next author is British as well, but at least she's a variability in gender. How about that? we have gender variable, if not nationality variable.
Yeah. Reynolds, who co-wrote this book with Evo Sullivan, called The Kitchen Shelf, and again, it's a real help to doing creative meals in the kitchen. They give you the basic larder, and then all you have to do is buy two ingredients to make a spectacular meal. Rosie Reynolds and Eve O'Sullivan, and we have Rosie on the line to talk to, and we don't have Eve on, but they co-wrote this book with an interesting concept. It's called The Kitchen Shelf, which is sort of self-explanatory. The concept is you take a few pantry essentials, add two ingredients from the store, and there you have your meal. When I was reading it, Rosie, I was thinking it's like a variation on the meal kit. Do you think?
On the what? Sorry, Anne, I didn't get that.
People,
on the...
maybe it's not common in the UK yet, since you are in the UK, but everybody's ordering this delivery service now, which is not just takeout, but they're actually meal kits. They give you the essential ingredients.
I didn't hear correctly, but absolutely, I mean, kind of a variation on that, but in a way it's almost easier because the thing is that if you go out and buy the 10 essentials that we have, that we sort of, they're the basis of one or more of the meals, and then the spice rack that we have, which is a comprehensive spice rack.
Yeah, well, that's where it goes. Tell us, let's just review your 10 essentials. Some people might be surprised. I must say that I have probably all of these in my pantry, except for the peanut butter, since Peter hates peanut butter.
Oh, no way. Who doesn't like peanut butter?
I think it reminds me of something else that's about the same color.
He doesn't like
it. Oh, Peter.
I thought I said it rather nicely.
Well, you did, quite. Okay, so the 10, our 10 essentials that we think that, I mean, we certainly always have these in our cupboard or a variation thereof. And most people that we spoke to when we were compiling this list of essentials were in agreement with us. So they are a can of chickpeas, a bag of rice, a can of chopped tomatoes, bag of flour, a jar of peanut butter, a box of eggs, a bag of pasta, a can of coconut milk, a bar of chocolate, and a carton of normal milk, so dairy or whatever non-dairy milk that you have. And so all of the recipes in the book, each of these 10 key essentials has a chapter, and all of the recipes, the essential is the starting point for the recipe. So, I mean, we've got all sorts. We've got stews made with chickpeas. We've got a really amazing fudgy brownie that's got chickpeas in it. We've got salads. You know, it's absolutely such a varied cross-section of foods that we've got, and they all use one or more of these essentials, plus this brilliant streamlined spice rack, which we really think a lot of people are going to have already on their kitchen shelf.
And then you have shelf essentials, and they are essential. For you to get away with those 10 basic ingredients, you got to have a lot more things. And those are salt, pepper, olive oil, white wine vinegar, bouillon or stock cubes, ground turmeric, which, by the way, usually is not in anybody's. We've recently fallen in love with fresh turmeric root, but usually most people don't have that on their shelf.
Well, now they will. If they buy this book, they will.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a versatile ingredient as well, turmeric, as you've recently found out. And, you know, you can make anything from a really delicious, soothing turmeric tonic. And, it's used in so many different cuisines of, you know, from India and Asia all the way through to, English food, like something that you might not traditionally make in America, something like a kind of, you know, a kedgeree. You have turmeric in that, and it's absolutely delicious, and it's got such a vibrant colour that once you start using it, you really don't want to not use it, because it makes everything look so delicious.
Is that what makes kedgeree that colour?
It certainly is, yeah. It makes it bright yellow, yeah.
I never knew that.
I've never made it, so...
Well, you never made it.
British breakfast dish, but a little bit like kippers in a way, but not quite the same.
It's from Indian influence dish, I don't think it's something that's that popular in America. And we had somebody at the publishing house, Fiden, who made this dish, and we're like, oh, we can't get our head around fish, eggs, rice. And then they made it, and they're like blown away by it. And you know, that's what you want, isn't it? When you write a recipe, you want other people to cook it and think, "Wow, this is so simple and tasty, and looks great, and you know, really, really impressed by something that they'd never tried before." So that was a result.
Now, the only question I had on your ingredients was the chickpeas. I don't imagine my sister having chickpeas in her cupboard, although she may.
She would. Remember, she used to make.
She made carrot soup with something in it.
She makes soup a lot.
One thing we might find, we certainly in our in one of our niece's pantries, is mushy peas in a can.
Mushy peas in a can. She's obviously from the north of England.
She is from the north of England, but it still seems like rubbish.
Yeah. Our son fell in love with mushy peas. He was bringing cans back. Our son did, yeah. He used to bring back mushy peas.
They are amazing. So, I mean, if your sister doesn't have chickpeas on her kitchen shelf, but she does have a tin of cannellini beans or a tin of haricot beans.
That would be all right. There you go. Okay.
Well, so we've always had
the recipes will still work, but it's just a different bean. But they'll still be delicious. You know, the bean adds texture and, you know, body, taste. Mushy peas, you're not going to be able to use, I'm afraid, Peter. any other type of bean,
I really wouldn't want to. Now, we have a purveyor of heirloom beans here in the United States, based in California, called Rancho Gordo, and they have the most amazingly different colored beans.
Oh, wow, amazing. You could take one of our recipes and you could throw in these, is it Rancho Gordo?
Rancho Gordo.
Rancho Gordo.
Yeah. They're all dried.
Them and you'd have this amazing multicolored salad in front of you that would just be incredible.
And it'd be
interesting to see a picture. If we make one of the recipes with them.
If we do
Rosie,
that.
Rosie, I don't think you grew up on these dishes. I mean, how about spiced chickpea and mackerel salad? How common was that in your hometown?
Well, you know, that's just one of those things that's just such a really good go-to recipe.
It sounds fabulous.
It is really tasty and delicious. And, you know, smoked mackerel is one of those things that you buy in the store that's in the fridge compartment. It's in a vac pack. Really easy. And, you know, the usual way is that you just open the vac pack and you might eat it on a slice of rye bread or something with some horseradish. But, you know, mixing it in with some chickpeas and some spices and some dill, you know, it just elevates the flavours. It's so great and it's so easy, and it's the sort of thing that you can whip up for dinner and then you can pack the rest of it for, you know, for lunch the next day. It's got really great recipes that they've got lots of mileage. And also a really good thing with all the recipes is that, you know, if you make them once and you think to yourself, oh, I'm not really sure about dill, I don't really like it, or if you, you know, and if you make it and then Peter says, I'm not fond of the smoked mackerel, but you think, this would be great if we use salmon fillets. You know, you can take the recipe and you can swap in and out ingredients that you like and that you'd prefer, which, you know, the recipe will still work, it will still taste great, it will still turn out how it should do. It's just that you're going to put your own stamp on it.
I would have another component. I'm a big believer, not just in the dry pantry, but or canned or tin pantry, but in the freezer. I mean, there are things that go in a freezer that will save you on any given occasion, such as a bag of frozen shrimp, already peeled and deveined.
Yes, absolutely. And perfect example of something that is, you've always got it to hand, haven't you? I mean, we've got a really gorgeous shrimp curry, which is, you know, you use tinned tomatoes, all the spice mix, onion, and then you throw in some spinach and some frozen shrimp, some fresh shrimp, sorry. But if you had frozen shrimp in your freezer that you always have there to hand, and then, you know, on the way home from work, it would be as easy as going to the store and buying a bag of spinach. You know, you could make it even easier. You could have frozen spinach as well. But, you know, we've made our, you know, our two fresh ingredients in this recipe, a bag of fresh spinach and a box of shrimp. But, you know, Anne, you are absolutely right. If you've got these things in your freezer and you want to use them, follow the recipe and defrost your shrimp and defrost your spinach and throw it in, and you're just going to have such a quick meal that it tastes incredible. And you haven't even had to leave the house to be able to prepare it, which is, how good is that?
Right. Some of your presentations are unusual, such as your eggplant pasta pie. It's beautiful.
Good, unusual, we think.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an unusual dish, isn't it, the pasta pie? But what a show-off dish, you know, if you've had friends round and you bring that to the table. I don't think anybody would expect something so amazing, you know. It's just, you cut into it and you've got all this really tasty tomato-y pasta with mozzarella, and then encased in that gorgeous griddled eggplant, which it just looks so incredible. And it's really, really not difficult to make, to prepare and to construct. And I think if you can, you know, if you have some friends over and you can do that and you can give yourself brownie points for making something that looks incredibly stylish as well as tasting good, then I think that's a good thing.
Now, are you doing like a book tour? Are you getting feedback on your book? I'd be interested in knowing what people say to it.
Yeah, well, you know, we've done, what we did was before the book was released officially on Monday, and what we did was we sent the book out for a few people before it was released officially. And the few people that I sent it to are really good friends of mine. So I've got one friend who is a doctor, and my other friend is a new mum, and another friend who doesn't cook, and he really doesn't cook. And these three people have given really, really amazing feedback. So the friend who's a doctor, long hours, really, really hard. You know, he doesn't come in till late at night, and he eats lots of convenience food, and he said that he really wanted to try and stop it. And so this book has afforded him this kind of, you know, a new approach, because what he does is he just goes to, a local store on the way home from work, whatever time it is, picks up the ingredients, and then whip something up together, or he'll make it one night and he'll keep the remainder for the next day in a pack, in a Tupperware. And then the friend who's a, she's a new mum, she said it's just, absolutely changed the way she cooks, because she went out and she bought the 10 ingredients of the essentials, and she stocked a spice rack. And so now all she has to do is go and buy the 2 additional ingredients in the day, or she can do it on a shopping delivery, and she can whip up a meal from start to finish without, you know, having every night to think, what am I going to have? What am I going to do? It takes the sting out of cooking, really, because you can just, you know, you just need these 2 ingredients if you've got your fully stocked kitchen shelf. So, you know, the feedback has been so positive, and one of the most brilliant things about the feedback is that everybody's saying, oh my God, the recipe works.
Well, of course, yeah, of course it did, right? Of course it did. It worked. You sweated over that, made sure it worked. Tell you what, we have a nephew who's a nurse, whose wife is a doctor, and yeah. I have a feeling we might pass our copy along to them, because they're certainly in that daily crisis mode.
when you walk around, I spend a lot of my time in the supermarket, as you can probably imagine. I'm a food stylist, that's what I do. I go shopping, I make food look beautiful, and I'm looking at people, and you can see the pain on their face when they're in the supermarket, and people just can't, you know, it's an awful decision, isn't it, when you are so hungry, and you're just, it becomes a sort of a minefield. You're looking and you're thinking, oh, I could have pasta. Oh, I could have baked potato. Oh, I could have curry. Oh, I could just get a takeaway meal. And I think, you know, when you're faced with that, if you've got a book that you can go to, that's really simple, straightforward, but it's going to give you something tasty and stylish and delicious and easy to prepare, and you know it's going to work and you can trust it. I think, you know, I want to go up to people and tap them on the shoulder and say, you need to get this book. It's called The Kitchen Shelf.
You ought to do a deal with Tesco. Put the book in. Put the book behind the counter.
Get a T-shirt with "You need to buy the kitchen shelf" on it.
Makes
life easy.
Well, you certainly made having interesting and varied meals easy with this book, Rosie Reynolds. Again, it's called The Kitchen Shelf. And listeners, you'll be amazed at how you can become a star chef with just 10 ingredients and a variety of kitchen pantry essentials. Well, I wish you luck with this book, Rosie.
Oh, thank you so much, and so nice to speak to you both.
Yes, and hello to Eve.
If you do make any of the food, I would absolutely love to see pictures of it. And I want your feedback, Anne.
Okay. I do most of the cooking. I'm lucky if I get it on the table. I don't know that I photograph a lot of it, but I'll definitely try.
Oh, perfect. Thank you. That's great.
Thank you, Rosie. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And who do we have closing out today's program, Levice?
Well,
I'll
give you a little secret. Jessica Emmett is not British, but she is uniquely to our show. I mean, at least it's the first one our show. She's one of a set of triplets born minutes apart called the Blissful Sisters. And she's going to teach us how to eat, drink, and shine. Well, we're going to be talking to one of the Blissful Sisters. I'm just absolutely enthralled, Jessica Emick. You're triplets. You look identical, but you said like 2 of you are identical and the other one's fraternal. I've never seen anything quite like it. I was thinking it's a good thing that you're good looking, because there are 3 of you.
Well, I appreciate that.
She's very tactful. You notice that.
Yeah. Hey, I'm a Jersey girl. I could take it.
So the book we're going to be talking to you about is called Eat, Drink, shine, inspiration from our kitchen. But we're going to be talking about a bunch of other things. You have other businesses. You have an interesting history. You have a philosophy of food and of life. And it's a whole revelation, this book. The recipes are gluten-free and paleo-friendly. Right?
Yes.
You've been at this for a long time with this restaurant, huh?
We've been at it for a very long time, over 20 years.
Right. And you're young. You started it young.
We did. We actually opened our first restaurant at the age of 24.
Uh-huh.
When we were young and naive enough to actually do it.
Now, where was that one, Jessica?
That was also in Boulder, Colorado.
That was in Boulder. Okay. So, mm-hmm. so Boulder is the... is consistent throughout your story.
It is. I mean, we did go to college in Las Vegas at UNLV. Okay. Joe and I did for hotel restaurant management, and then went on to San Francisco to the California Culinary Academy, and then moved to Boulder and worked around some, and then opened our first restaurant in Boulder and our second restaurant in Boulder.
Now, are you the one that has the nutrition degree as well?
I am.
And it's holistic nutrition, which is a really hot topic right now.
It is.
I was so thrilled to find out. I'm always thrilled that people believe in the microbiome like I do.
Absolutely.
Well, people, they sort of get their eyes glaze over and they try to switch the subject if I start talking about it.
Yeah.
The thing is, it
will always come back. You know,
I thought that
we're all connected to it.
I thought holistic was food that had been prepared in a sieve.
I've never heard of that. That is really crazy.
That is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, but you
well, a colander, I guess. A colander would be more accurate.
Colander, okay.
Holy, I got it, holy.
Hey, well done.
I got you.
So, well, you start out with your introduction, giving your story, which, as I said, it's not simplistic. I mean, you've had a number of ups and downs. You have reason to not be always so blissful. You have an older brother who's very ill, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and you had one of your sisters had the breast cancer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you sort of sworn by your body and nutritional feeding of your body that kind of spiritual care of your spirit, you know, of your body for keeping everybody on keel and your brother still alive and you're healthy.
Yes. Yes. It's been, you know, I've just really grown to understand the connection between well-being and food. You know, food has become such big business and so many people look at it as like this, you know, mouth experience. You know, you go out to an expensive dinner, you eat something, it tastes delicious and like it ends there. But being in the restaurant business for so long, as well as having a brother that had high needs for nutrition, and then my sister healing from cancer, I really was putting together this connection of food and what you eat really interacts and affects every relationship of your life because it affects your well-being and your spirit. And so once you really have that knowledge and that clicks, there's really no turning back on paying attention to what A, I'm feeding myself, but also my responsibility as a chef in what I'm feeding others.
Yes, and you have, throughout the book, you have indicated things that are paleo-inspired, mm-hmm. dairy-free, vegetarian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This paleo diet, Peter said to me, what's that? I said, well, it's been hot for about 5 years at least. Why is it, the one thing that bothers me about the paleo diet, why is it that they don't like pulses or legumes?
Well, here's the thing about legumes or pulses. They can be nutritionally valuable. However, the way that they are in nature, they have a protective coating on them, and that's to protect them in nature from birds and whatnot. So this protective coating is still on it when it's harvested, and it makes it hard to digest for most people. And so it's your body reacts to it. So it has a reaction to it in the way of guts overworking, or your body is trying to create a whole food out of it because it's recognizing it not as a whole food because it's not all accessible and its nutritional value. And so, but what I believe and what we do at my restaurant and what we talk about in the book is when you soak, even just overnight or 6 to 8 hours, this changes it. And that takes off that protective coating. So then it renders it much more digestible and more nutritionally valuable. And that works for a lot of people, but that in itself doesn't work for all people. So some people do well with them and some people don't, even if they're soaked. But I'm not an all or nothing type of person. We're all so different, and I'm well aware of that too. And I always feel that when I'm talking or serving people, for sure.
You say you're 80-20 person. So we will find recipes in this book that are not in line with those specified diets, right?
Correct. Like, we have a sprouted tabbouleh quinoa, so we sprout the quinoa first, and then we create this beautiful tabbouleh out of it, and it's crunchy, and it's wonderful, and it's served with our beet hummus, which is a really nice beet hummus that's actually done without the garbanzo beans, but it's done with beets and garlic and lemon juice and tahini. So there's definitely some sprinkled in there that are grains, and there's definitely some dairy in there, for sure.
Yeah, I'm looking at the photograph now. It's vivid, and that's what they tell you. The more vividly colored the foods, the more healthful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, very true.
Readers or users of the book will feel like they're getting very close to all of you, because periodically you insert a little colored box with personal comments from identified by who it is. Here's one from Jill talking about amaranth porridge.
Mm-hmm.
You start out, which I thought was interesting, is your morning ritual begin with. Not a single one of you likes to get up and grab a cup of coffee like I do.
Well, I'll tell you what, I do like my coffee or my mate, but I just like to drink warm water with lemon first. And then I actually feel like the coffee is even more effective, quite honestly, for one. And number two, my belly's happier, and I feel like I've moved through all the gunk from, you know, sleeping in the night and all that happens in the night. And then, I'm reaching for that coffee, too.
Is it warm water? Because Peter's mother always had warm water first thing in the morning.
Yeah, she had boiled water. I never understood why. She never explained it, because she never explained anything.
She gets everything.
To do with cooking,
so. She says, look what I do and do it. I don't have to tell you why.
Yeah, exactly. And you can have cornflakes.
Yeah.
And maybe if you're lucky, you can have a boiled egg.
Yeah, you like boiled eggs. You have a very nice recipe for boiled eggs.
Yes, my mom used to boil its eggs all the time. So here we can
engage you in a dialogue about whether or not you start the timing when the water is cold or when the water is hot.
I start it, and I set it in the book when it's cold.
So you start timing from cold.
Yep.
Okay.
And then I did that in the book. There's
yeah, you have
ways.
A recipe for it in a book here. We've been, you have a little note that I found amusing thing. It makes me realize, there are a lot of people who, you just can't even imagine how people don't think of things. And so you mentioned that the temperature and the size of the eggs matters with the timing.
But it does. Here's the thing about boiling an egg. Like, eggs are so different, you know.
Oh,
and some
sure.
people have their eggs on their countertop, and some people have them in their fridge, and some people are using huge eggs, and some people are using, you know, smaller eggs. So, like, there's a little leeway, and I want to help as much as possible, but sometimes we got to think about it, too.
Do you know Kenji of the Food Lab?
Yes.
Well, I mean, he has his recipe for soft boiling eggs, and we tried it, and it didn't work for us because we were using jumbo eggs.
It actually does work now.
It does work now, yes.
We calibrated it differently. That's all. We started out at 5.5 minutes, and we're now at seven minutes and a few seconds from boiling water from a kettle. And until we serve it, and the interesting thing was, he said, if you do it that way, it's much easier to get the egg off of the skin inside.
It's true.
And that turns out to be true.
Yeah.
So that's really very interesting. And we found out something a few weeks before that when we were talking about hard-boiled eggs. I had always thought it really didn't matter how long you cooked them.
Oh, no. It doesn't matter.
Oh, honey.
Well, what do I know? My mother used to boil eggs when I was a child. So I learned that if you boil them too long, then the yolk gets that kind of greenish tinge on the outside, and you don't want that.
You don't want it. It's kind of grainy and icky, and believe me, my kids will be the first to tell me when the egg's overboiled.
Oh, there you go.
Right. Oh, you're very sensitive.
And
kids.
I will say too, the fresher the egg, the harder they are to peel. So that's So that's a challenge sometimes too.
Now you're a fan of culturing and fermenting.
I am.
And I am as well. In fact, I'm just trying to debate at which point I give in on my preserved lemons and stick them in the fridge. I think they're soft.
Yeah, I know. There's that sweet spot. You just got to hit it.
Yeah. So they're getting a little mushy, so I think it's time to move them to the fridge, right?
Absolutely.
You said you have one recipe. Now, I can't find the recipe here, but I noted that you have a recipe that calls for some seaweed.
Oh, yes.
And my theory is, I kept wanting to write an article about it, except the seaweed suppliers in this country, well, they're on the internet, are so stingy, and some of the seaweed costs a fortune, you know. But I think it's where we're moving. People keep presenting, what's the next kale? Well, I think seaweed is the next kale.
I think it can be and should be, to be honest. I mean, it's so nutrient dense, and it's easily regenerated if it's done right. And I think a lot of the things it has, like the precious minerals and the iodine, are things that are really missing and lacking in our diet and essentially our soil. And so I think it's such an important addition to people's diets.
Must be kind of hard to get in Boulder.
Well, here's the thing. I have a great source.
Okay.
As I do for most things that I love.
Great. Well,
what is your source? Can you share?
Well, I use, and she's a little smaller, but it's the Mendocino Seaweed Company, and her name's Barbara, and she hand harvests. She's one of the only ones that hand harvests, and I love her product. It's clean. She's certified. You know, it's low in radiation and all of that stuff. So I know that it's healthy, and I can monitor it and make sure, like, that all the testing is done. And another one I like that's a little bigger and that you can find in most health food stores is Rising Tide Seaweeds, and those are mostly hand harvested as well, which is important for the regeneration and regrowth, and they're tested as well, which you can find online. So I like those two brands.
Okay, Rising Tide, and what's the first one?
Mendocino
Seaweed Company. And she's a little smaller. Like, if you go to her website, you'll see, like, that's more of a family business. But Rising Tide is a little more, like, of a mainstream, bigger producer. Uh-huh. But if you can get in touch with Barb, you know, she would definitely ship it, for sure.
Good, because most of these places don't want to be bothered with small orders, and they're selling for, like, over $100 an ounce for some of these seaweed.
It's crazy. See, what I love about, you know, Barb is she wants people to have her seaweed, and she, you know, harvests by the full moon, and, like, she has so much passion into it, and her passion translates into, like, yes, I want people to have it. I want it to be accessible, you know. So she will talk your ear off about it all day, and her prices are reasonable. It's not cheap, but it shouldn't be cheap for what she's doing, you know.
Right, I get that. Well, okay, I'd recommend this book to anybody listening, the basis of the soundness of your philosophy about food, the interest that you add to all this, all the recipes, with your individual personalities, which are kind of extraordinary. I think you point out that because you were all treated as triplets and dressed the same, that you made a big effort to become individual in expressing your individual personalities. And then also on the basis of the recipes happen to be very good. So,
thank you. So have you tried some recipes?
I can read them. I've been at this for so long, I can read the recipe. I will try, of course, but I could see from reading.
Okay.
I mean, I've written cookbooks, and, you know, could tell from looking at the recipe what's coming down. And
they're simple, they're straightforward, easy to understand,
yeah,
accessible.
And I'm glad you like chickpeas.
I do. There's I definitely do. You won't find them in my hummus, but you will find them on the Caesar salad.
Yes, there are two. I have two recipes right here that are all. And you like arugula, which is a weed in my garden. I've planted it for so many years.
Well, lucky you.
And you make pesto with arugula, which I do too. In fact, I was going to do that today. I have two big batches of, plants of wild, highly peppery, serrated leaf.
Okay.
Yeah,
this is the time of year.
Yep. Well, good luck with this book and with your lives, Jessica, and hello to your sisters.
Thank you. I really appreciate you doing this, and, you know, we're so psyched about this book, and it is available wherever books are for sale, as well as Amazon, so I encourage everybody to go out and buy it.
And people can become aware of your restaurants and your community. Just give us the website again just before we close.
Sure. It's shineboulder.com.
There you go, and it's in Boulder, Colorado, where the mountains probably still have snow on them in the background.
They sure do, and it's gorgeous.
it's one of the more elementally beautiful landscape shots in the whole of the United States.
Yes.
I will say it sure is. I feel blessed.
Well, thank you, Jessica.
Okay, take good care, and I appreciate it so much.
You too.
So there you have it, listeners, a bonus program in length today. We hope you enjoyed it and got some great ideas. And you'll come back and join us same time, same place next week, where we'll have more culinary and travel adventures for you here at onthemenuradio.com. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.